education should be fun, engaging. It should be at least as much fun as a hockey game or a football game or the ballet or the Olympics. And why is it? I mean, you look at a game like chess, which is very difficult. It's fun. They make it fun. I mean, chess is a lot more difficult than calculus. And yet, once it's a game, it's fun. So why shouldn't reading a book and doing your math homework be fun? Why structure it in a way that actually kills people's imagination?
You're listening to Tickets, a podcast series featuring the visionaries, producers and operators behind some of the world's most exciting and innovative live experiences. Joining the dots between disciplines, Tickets seeks to find out what goes into bringing amazing ideas, companies and concepts to life. In this, our second season, we're exploring the future of education and how emerging forms of technology and entertainment are changing the ways we learn and interact. My name's Howard Gray and I'm your host. Think about talent agents, and the first image that comes to mind may be something similar to the character of Ari Gold in the TV show Entourage. Fast-talking, fickle, and more focused on the action toys and the awards than the quality of the art. But beyond the caricature, there's of course far more to this kind of work than meets the eye, and a growing range of talent with important ideas to share with the world. On this episode of Tickets, I'm joined by David Lavin, founder and CEO of the Lavin Agency. The agency represents some of the world's leading intellectual talent, from Salman Rushdie and Margaret Atwood to Angela Duckworth and Steven Pinker. During this conversation, we get into what really makes for a compelling speaker, where there's space for new ideas in education, balancing risk and reward, and who's really worth booking for the $10,000 keynote. Enjoy. We're back at the studio in the Flatiron District of New York City for another episode of Tickets. I'm delighted to welcome today's guest, David Lavin, who is founder and CEO of the Lavin Agency. This podcast is all about education, live experiences and entertainment, and the intersection of those disciplines. So I think today's conversation is going to be really interesting. We're going to be covering all three of those areas and much more. So, David, maybe let's just get started with the origin story and how it all began for you working in this area.
I was unemployed, unemployable, and a young lady broke my heart. I didn't go to university. I was lucky, and I was the youngest chess master in Canada, so I took my university grant money and I went to California and then lived in a tent in Ibiza for 3 months and lived in Berlin and various other places. And when I was 26, I came back and the young lady said, "How do you expect to look after a family?" And I said, "Hey, I can do anything," because I didn't understand the subtext of the question. And so she dumped me for an MBA student, and I've hated them ever since. And I said, well, if I can do anything, maybe I should do something. So I tried various things. I tried to become a promoter. So I tried calling up some comedy agents, and somebody said, "Why should I give you my biggest star?" And I thought, that's actually a very reasonable question. Why should he? So I just said, comedy's not going to work. So I looked for people who were sort of underrepresented in the public theater. And so the first person I decided to become a promoter of live events.
And where was this?
This is in Toronto.
Yeah.
So traditional lectures are in, back then, we're talking 30 years ago, they were in church basements, 50 people would show up. And I decided to treat it like a rock concert. So the first person I tracked down was Hunter S. Thompson. And I could talk for about another 2 hours about that experience. Because basically Hunter came for six days and then left just before the event was supposed to start. And he came back 3 weeks later, and we ended up having almost 2,500 people show up, so which is a much, much different than 50. And it was an amazing, very interesting experience. And I stood outside and I said, "I'll never do anything like that again. That was insane." Because at one point I'd been standing outside saying, "It's sold out, and he's not here." And people were trying to buy tickets as souvenirs. And I was like, I've just lost every penny I've ever had in my life. This is like, it's all over. And somebody, there was a journalist there who said, you know, a political journalist actually said, you know, I've never seen anybody handle a crisis like this. You know, 27 is the first one you've
done. This is your first gig.
This is my first gig. Your first gig. To tell you how bad it was at one, for the second gig, the entire city of Toronto, like SWAT team, the tactical SWAT team, was lined up in front of the theater in their squad cars because they thought there were going to be riots. And there weren't. Thankfully, because we're Canadian, you know, there's only so many riots we could do. And so they talked me into saying, say, like, it'll never be this weird again. It'll be okay. It'll be okay. And I thought about it. I did it. So I did the next event I did was with Harlan Ellison, who most people probably don't know. But the one after that was the first and only time that these three people were ever in the same room together. And that was Abbie Hoffman, Timothy Leary, and Eldridge Cleaver. So you had the founder of the Yippie movement, the hippie movement, and LSD turned on Timothy Leary, and Eldridge Cleaver, who was the co-founder of the Black Panthers, who stood on the stage in front of 2,500 people and said, "The proudest moment of my life is when I opened fire on the Oakland police."
Wow.
So it was fun. So I did that, and I somehow managed to convince a newspaper to give me $1 million in advertising space over 3 years and 100% editorial control to promote anything I wanted.
And you're still like a rookie at this point, right? You said that was your third?
That was my third event.
That was your event. Third event.
Yeah, so it was my third event. And at one point, the head of the newspaper marketing team said, "You know, David, I never asked you how you were financing this because I never wanted to know. And I always thought I'd have to bail you out. And we never did. And I'm really amazed and proud." And it worked out really well. Unfortunately, he got cancer and passed away. And he was the advocate and the others didn't get it. So I segued from promoting for 3 years. And then I moved into being an agent. But I found that corporate Canada didn't really want Eldridge Cleaver to talk as a motivational speaker. So I just sort of reinvent the whole thing. And at first I did what sort of other people did. We represent thousands of people. And then I thought about it. I said, look, I've read every Graham Greene novel. Ask me to give you a plot synopsis right now of all of them. I can't do that. So how can I possibly say I represent 35 economists and be able to differentiate between them all? So I just said, forget it. I'm going to go out and find people that I think are interesting and represent them. So I went out and I found an oncologist. And I got him to do talks about how to break bad news. And we booked him over 500 times. And then I found an investment banker who wanted to talk about entrepreneurship. I said, I can't convince IBM to book you to tell them why their employees should quit and start a new job. But as an investment banker, you have to predict the future. So why don't you become a futurist? He said, okay, I'll become a futurist. We booked him like 300 times. So I just looked for people that I thought were personally interesting. And I think the thing that I brought to the table was curiosity and taste. And which made me an advocate for what they did. And I always found that the difference I was told later between us and everybody else was that I would tell people who to book, and other people would say, who do you want to book for your event? And I would just tell them, if they told me who they wanted to book, I would just tell them that they were wrong and they should be booking somebody else who's better. And they would most of the time believe me.
I love that part about like finding the right angles, like the investment banker and IBM, it's not about telling everyone they should go and quit their jobs. That's not going to work. But you found that angle of what you think about what the banker does in another way, which is predicting the future.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of job, but then suddenly if you look at it through that different lens, that's suddenly far more appealing for the client to book that person to speak.
Well, it's about fit. It's about asking the client what they really want, because usually a client doesn't know what they want. Most people don't know what they want. I mean, you know, you walk into a furniture store, you don't know what you want. You know, you walk in, you know, you have to sort of educate yourself. And the best way to do that is by talking to somebody else who's knowledgeable, and you could go back and forth, and then you feel, no, you know, I really actually, you know, I thought I wanted X, but really the problem is Y. And assuming that the answer is X, but now that we've explored what the real problem is, we've found a different solution, and then we're going to go in that direction instead.
I just wanted to go back to what you said about when that changing point after 3 years as a promoter and you decided to become an agent. What was it that made that decision?
My wife was pregnant.
So how did that inform changing from being a promoter to an agent? I think I might know the answer, but please share.
Desperation is a wonderful motivator. And, you know, as a promoter, you could do like 10 events a year and you could make $10,000 in a day, but then you could lose $10,000 the next day. And so it became, whereas as an agent, I would just make a commission. And I know they told me about overhead and things like that. So I just thought, well, you know, I'll just make a, it seemed safer at a time when, you know, I was, I mean, I didn't make a lot of money as a promoter, and it was a lot of fun. But, I was getting bills I had to pay.
So you start this agency to kind of de-risk yourself somewhat, and you start booking talent. And in that first like couple of years, what did you learn in those early 2 years, 2-3 years?
Yeah, it is interesting that I thought being an agent wasn't risky, when actually that's an absurd assumption, isn't it?
Yep.
It was interesting. I mean, I what I learned was, I would just advocate for people that I thought were interesting. And it wasn't a big strategy. But when I started the industry, I didn't even know that anybody else did it. Literally, I hadn't done any market research, because as a promoter, I'd only worked with people in the U.S. So, for example, I did an event with the founder of the Contras, and I found him living on a fishing boat in Florida. And I paired him up with the CIA colonel who ran the covert war in Angola, and I called it Drugs, Guns, and the CIA. And, you know, it was sold out in like 4 seconds. And and the Canadian agent would call me up and say, would you like to, you know, I represent the host of the national news. Would you like him? And I was like, if I can find the founder of the Contras living off a fishing boat, I don't need you to help me find the national news guy. That's easy. Where are the ideas? And that's what I found, is that there were no ideas. Like, as a promoter, these were all my ideas. You know, I said, I went looking for Eldridge Cleaver and all of these people because I thought they would be interesting. I looked for the founder of the Contras because I thought this is going to be interesting back then. And whereas the agents were just, you know, they represent somebody, and if you want them, they quote a fee. So they were, there was no value added. And for me, it was just natural, because I'd always just been naturally curious. So when somebody said they were doing something, I would ask them, why are you doing this? And then we would find a solution. I saw it's like a chess game. It's like problem solving. You know, you've got this problem, you've got 400 people showing up, and you think they're going to be talking, you know, and you've got this issue with your company. So how do we solve this problem together?
How's the demand evolved over time? It sounds like those kind of first principles around being like curious and solving problems probably are still very much kind of at the core of what you're doing day to day. But how's the kind of demand and supply, I guess, kind of shifted over time after 20 or so years of being an agent?
Well, it's interesting. On the supply side, you know, there's a lot of people who want to make $10,000 an hour giving speeches, and not many of them should. I would say that there's a very large proportion of the people who are promoting themselves shouldn't be doing it. They're not their ideas. They're giving book reports. They read a bunch of stuff on a particular subject, and then they go and speak on it. And on the demand side, you know, the internet has been a big problem, because instead of enabling people to make decisions. So, you know, I've been doing this pre-internet, you know, and so what I would do is you know, I have a discussion with one person or maybe two people, and we would discuss what the problem is, and we'd figure out the solution. We'd have a speaker, and they would, you know, book them, and they would be happy. Now what happens is that there's 20 people involved, and they all have to watch the videos, and they all watch TED videos, or they all watch this video. And so I was speaking to one person who had 20 people on their speaking committee, and each person was charged with coming up with 20 suggestions. So that's 400 ideas for 3 speaking slots. Oof. Which is absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And they haven't even identified what problem they're trying to solve. So they're starting they're starting with the solution before they've figured out what the questions are. So I find the internet has oddly enough made people less curious and less willing to engage. And it's become more transactional, which is unfortunate.
And do you think it's stopping people asking questions because solutions are kind of pre-provided? So there's almost like the tyranny of choice, maybe to an extent, in that there's just so much choice out there. you don't need to be as critical with your thinking, and there's so much supply. Is that kind of what you're getting at, like those kind of factors combined?
It's some of that, and some of it is that I think there's just an assumption now that you do all your own research online. Like if you want to buy a refrigerator, what do? You used to go to a refrigerator store, and you talk to the salesperson, and you know, you'd figure it out. Now you go online, you investigate all this stuff. You spend 20 hours online. You go to the refrigerator store, and you tell them what you want, and the guy says, "Oh, you know, actually, I know that one sounds good, but this one's the same thing, but with one missing thing, but it's 20% cheaper. You should just buy this one." And you go, "Oh, okay." So you just spent 20 hours wasting your time when you could have actually just gone in and asked, you know, some knowledgeable people questions. I think this is essentially a distrust maybe of salespeople. You think if you go to the refrigerator store, they're going to lie to you. But, you know, I don't know if people have noticed, but sometimes there's all lies on the internet.
There might be
one or two, and also, you know, you get these speakers who go out there and they spend $100,000 on a video making themselves sound fantastic, and they call themselves. I saw one person, he called himself an expert on grit, and but this is the beauty of it. He wrote for the Harvard Business Review, which is very prestigious. So I go online and I look at it. He co-authored a one-page article in 2010 on their website, and the HBR website in 2010 wasn't anything that impressive. And that he used that as a credential, you know, and people hadn't reviewed it. They hadn't checked it themselves. They just accepted that this was that he was a writer for the HBR.
So I think that's really interesting around kind of filtering and signaling, and yet the fact that there are maybe untruths on the internet. How, I guess, kind of two things there for me is, like, firstly, how do you stop the shortage of people who should be giving the $10,000 speech, because it sounds like there's maybe a shortage of those who should be. And how do you as an agent or assisting a talent buyer, how do you filter the people that aren't worth the $10,000?
Well, it's a great question, but because actually some buyers don't care. As long as they're good, they don't care. I mean, one of the interesting fictions that has dominated the speaking industry for the last 5 years is that millennials are all entitled. And people have made millions and millions of dollars talking about the entitled millennials and all of these generational talks. There was no academic research anywhere in the world by anybody that will confirm this, or no academic who's done research on this has ever said that millennials are entitled, that there's any evidence for this. But it sounds good, so people make a fortune speaking on it. Worse now, so your company, you believe this. So now you're modifying your HR. So, we don't want to hire millennials maybe because they're entitled. So you're actually making very bad hiring decisions based on bad information because they were a good speaker.
It kind of brings to mind...
politics.
Something I read recently around blogging, and someone who's a very successful blogger, ostensibly, said that he spends 80% of his time on the headline. Mm-hmm. Because the headline's what catches. And kind of what you said reminds me of that, in that if the headline catches people around, say, the headline being millennials are entitled, it's like clickbait, right? It's almost like that kind of BuzzFeed style thing of just grabbing people's attention, and people will buy that.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of uncritical. They're like the Kim Kardashians of the speaker world. I mean, there's really no substance there. It's famous for being famous after a while. Like, I've encountered people who are very famous within the speaking world. The public has never heard of them, but they're out there all the time, and everything they say is wrong. You know, there's no credibility. And so I always think, you know, you've got to check, why are these people credible? You know, where do they teach? Have they ever actually, you know, walked the walk? You know, like what we say is, you know, we represent people who have day jobs, you know, so therefore their information changes. You get these people who, they run a consultancy of one person, and they're giving you business. I mean, it's... You know, I could rant some more, but, you know,
I kind of like that simple heuristic of they've got a day job. It sounds kind of counterintuitive, right? Because they should be a full-time speaker. But actually, ironically, because they've got a day job, it almost ensures that they're probably going to be an expert and very, very capable and very, very knowledgeable, because they're spending most of their time not speaking and actually working in their particular field of expertise.
Well, yeah, if you're talking about marketing and you haven't had a day job in 10 years, chances are your marketing knowledge is a little dated. Whereas if you've got a day job and you've just got to change, or if you're a professor that's in there consulting, you know, then your ideas change from 1 month to the next, or they build. And that's what you're looking for. You're looking for cutting edge information, not 5 years old.
So on top of, like, having a day job, what else makes for a great speaker in your experience?
I think original thinkers, it's interesting, the idea of like frequency. People always say to me, I want a great speaker. And I always say, you think to myself, you don't want a great speaker. You want a compelling speaker. This is very different. You know, a great speaker is somebody they watch, you know, a 20-second video clip, and they jump up and down, and you can be all you can be. And they say that's, or they you laugh at it, and they think that's a great speaker. But let's put some context on this. You know, who's your favorite? Think of your favorite musician. You know, think of Bruce Springsteen. Have you ever watched 4 hours of Bruce Springsteen videos? No. You'd like, no. Nobody would ever do that. But would you spend 4 hours at a live concert with Bruce Springsteen? You know, yeah, absolutely. People line up for hours to do that. Because a live experience is radically different than watching something on a 20-inch TV screen. And people don't understand that a speech is actually live theater. It is not a video. It is live theater. And live theater is a lot different because when you're in that room, you can't go to the fridge and get a beer. You can't check your email. You can't, you know, start talking to the person next to you. You can't be distracted. So you actually have to listen. And that's when you start to feel that, okay, if you've got a compelling speaker on the stage, you will listen. You know, it's the difference between, you know, The Godfather is not Guardians of the Galaxy. But it is a compelling movie that will encourage you to watch it again and again and again because you always get something new out of it. I mean, if they made The Godfather now, they'd probably have to, you know, blow Sonny up with, you know, special...
There'd be a lot of CGI going on, yeah.
Yeah, they'd be shooting him into outer space, you know. I mean, if you had The Godfather, there's no blood in the entire movie. But now, you see, we like things to blow up, or we like the laughter, or we like this, but no, compelling. Like the best speaker I've ever seen in my life. I remember it. I saw this speech. He got 2 standing ovations at the speech. 2. Like, who gets that? So I showed people this speech, and they all say he's boring. Why do they say he's boring? Because they're not paying attention. I was at I sat in on a board meeting recently, and the boss turned and said, "This person's, you know, boring." And I said, "Well, I understand why you say that, because for the last 10 minutes you've been reading your email off your phone. But see that person on the screen just to the left? That's Jeff Bezos. And he's giving this guy a standing ovation. So if Jeff Bezos is willing to not read his email for 10 minutes and give this person a standing ovation, maybe he's actually a good speaker."
So I love the kind of drawing that line between, say, the Godfather and the equivalent in kind of public speaking, and that there's barely any blood. And so it's almost like what you don't see. And the and the narrative and the story arc. And so if we're thinking about what makes a compelling speaker rather than what makes a great speaker, how much of that is around tension, narrative, story, pacing, as well as the content and the expertise the speaker's got?
Well, a lot of it, part of me feels this, that if you've got the expertise and you've got a reasonable ability to convey it, then you create the atmosphere where people want to listen. And it's like, you know, another favorite, Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront. You know, the best scene in that, actually, where I shouldn't be admitting this, but the best scene in the entire movie is when he doesn't speak, because there's the train going above him, and you've been waiting an hour for this moment to hear how he's going to explain how he killed his girlfriend's brother, which is it's a faux pas. And she's been waiting all movie for this, and then the train goes, and you don't hear it. But it's compelling, it's powerful. So it's not jumping up and down. It's not funny. It's like you've been waiting for this. You've got to hear it. And that's what you want from a speaker. You want that theater. And, you know, and Marlon Brando didn't have any PowerPoint in that film.
No.
No CGI, no PowerPoint. Just a great story well told.
So maybe thinking about emerging talent. So you, obviously you represent some of the kind of the finest intellectuals in the world, people who are internationally renowned award winners. When you're thinking about identifying new talent, and maybe you haven't seen them speak yet, or you've just heard about them through a referral or just through reading some of their work, what are the things that tend to jump out at you, or be factors that help you make a decision about whether they're a talent that you want to represent?
Well, the fun part is finding talent. I mean, most of the people that we work with had never given a speech for money before. I mean, it's great to represent, you know, Salman Rushdie and Margaret Atwood, and they look at it and say, well, if you can represent these people I've never heard of and do a good job, you can probably represent me as well, how one of them described why they signed with us. But finding people who just have something new to say, That's the exciting thing. And anybody can represent, you know, an ex-politician. But finding the next star, like, you know, we've had over 50 of our clients speak at TED. And most of those people are people that we signed years in advance. So like 2 years ago, the top two rated speakers at TED were people that we signed in 2009. And it's fun to anticipate the zeitgeist.
Do you think, is it nature or nurture becoming a compelling speaker? Is it something that's just innate as a talent? Or do you think that being an expert in a particular field, you can then learn the skills to be able to convey those messages in a compelling way to an audience?
I think a lot of it is nature. You can become a better speaker. And, I've talked about different ways that people can do that. And so different ways that people shouldn't do it. I mean, people get up there and they memorize speeches. And I always say that the reason people memorize speeches is because they're going to lie. And therefore, if you're a politician or a CEO, you might have to memorize the speech because you need to remember which lie you told and when you told it so you can tell it again the same way later. But if you're actually if you actually have 50 hours worth of material, you just get up there and you can it's like, which hour do you want to hear? Let's figure out between us, what we're going to talk, what you want to hear. It's always about the connection between the audience. What I tell clients is that, we often get up there and say, this is what I want to tell you. I said, that's irrelevant. I don't care what you want to tell the audience. What does the audience want to hear and why? That's the key thing. And authenticity, it's your story. That's what I say. I see some of these speakers and I could get up there, I could give their speech. It's so cookie cutter. There's no there. Whereas, the person who's giving the speech, they should be the only person in the world who should be able to give that speech because they're the ones who did the research. They're the ones who had those experiences. They're the ones who discovered X.
Some advice I was given when I was an agent a little while ago now was so seemingly counterintuitive on the surface of the, you don't just represent the talent, you're also acting as a kind of conduit and partner to the buyer or the promoter as well. And I think you kind of touched on that earlier with asking good questions and curiosity. When it comes to what talent buyers are purchasing and why they're buying and who they want to book and why, and we're talking about audiences specifically, what audiences want to learn, what are you noticing maybe right now that buyers are asking you or the audiences are really kind of passionate about finding out more about?
Yeah, it's great. To back it up slightly, what I try and do is I always think that if based on my knowledge of the speakers, if I suddenly had that person's job, and who would I book? Mm. Right. And that's what I was trying to do is that you ask enough questions so that, they're the experts on their audience. You're the expert on the speakers. So you actually, at the end of the day, only want to come up with one idea. You don't need to come up with 10.
Or 400, as you mentioned.
Or 400. Before. Yeah. You're looking for one and the right one. And then topic wise, the corporate world is very interested in AI innovation. What's happening next, but even more so now, I think implementation, execution. People are getting tired of all the big ideas that they can't implement. And I've always thought myself that execution is underrated, strategy is overrated. You rent strategy, but you buy execution. And I think more organizations are realizing that. An old maxim in chess, which is that a bad plan well executed will defeat a great plan poorly executed. And I think that's true in business. So execution is a big issue now. And AI, and that's where big data and AI come in. And people don't really understand that the point of big data and AI is actually to help people make better decisions faster and get things done. It's not just sort of gee whiz, CGI kind of thing. Because basically AI is a prediction machine. It's saying, what's the question, and here's an answer. And you can use that to actually get things done faster.
I think to that point about that maxim, I wonder, not to sidebar too much, maybe that's why some of the big management consultancy firms are buying execution. So there's lots of, like, McKinsey are buying kind of design agencies and other kind of more execution-focused companies and bringing them in, because I think corporate world businesses are looking at, okay, you can hire in strategy, but they are struggling with execution. So that's why the consultancies are now looking to bring in more execution-focused capabilities, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, I'm sure these large companies have, 100 miles worth of business plans and strategy plans that are gathering dust. They don't do anything with them. And you know, I think consulting firms have always been said, well, we suggested what to do and they just didn't execute. It's not our fault. And I think people are looking now for the next step.
So you mentioned in corporate, like AI innovation, a big kind of topics that people are gravitating towards and are interested in learning more about. So you talked around in university, people would stay up all night with their kind of these long discussions and curiosity. And a lot of what this podcast is about is kind of connecting education and entertainment. And we see this sort of term edutainment kind of coming up again and again. And also more broadly, the concept of lifelong learning. And lots of people probably would self-identify as being lifelong learners. But I'd love to get your take on maybe the validity of those phrases and whether you really do see that kind of intellectual curiosity and lifelong learning across the board.
Well, sadly, I think some of it's a placebo. If we say we're lifelong learners, or we say our company is, you know, really loves learning and education and all of this, but really, you learn something every few months, maybe, that's designed to, you know, make your job better. But it's not about learning something new that's engaging and exciting. So we're not lifelong learners. We learn most of what we learn that's new is probably under the age of 25. It's probably when we get 90% of our opinions and ideas and everything else, and then we spend the next 50 years acting on those. Well, why can't we do both? You know, why can't we continue to try and learn something new, whether it is a language? And why isn't this promoted more at your workplace? Are there book clubs in the workplace where they say, okay, we're going to get together and we're going to have Jared Diamond's book and we're going to talk about it? And everybody who wants to come gets a copy and then they can come and talk about it and over lunch. Or, what we do is we give a free college extension course to everybody in the company, whatever they want to take. I don't care what it is. You know, is it wine? Is it, related to the business? I don't care. But as long as you're learning something, because your brain is then moving. And we look for the utility. They have to learn something that we can use. But no, you just have to learn something. And that's how you remain curious. And that curiosity is what you bring back to the company, to or the organization, to make it more vibrant.
Do you think that utility part is somewhat stifling? Like, it makes sense on the surface that, okay, you should go and learn, if you're in the workplace, you should go and learn something about X because it's relevant to your job. But do you think that kind of very utilitarian focus can be dangerous in a way, or like or less productive?
Well, it can be boring.
It can be boring.
Well yeah. You're 16, 18, 20. Did you wake up in the morning and say, what can I do that's utilitarian today? I can hardly wait.
Definitely not.
You know, you might, you know, like, no. You said, what can I do that's going to really annoy my parents?
And maybe. Did.
Yeah. And so why are we still annoying our parents? You know, why do we suddenly forget what excites us about being alive? And actually, we focus on the boring. We focus on how can I do exactly what I did yesterday and last year, rather than, you know, how can I blow the doors off my brain?
What do you think is stopping that? Is it the fact that we learn everything when we're under 25? Or,
but I think what happens, I think it's almost institutional. It's like, you know, you've left university, so you stop, or you've left school, you stop learning, and now you're working. And work is all about implementing what you've learned. And there has to be some sort of other, you know, is education prioritized? I mean, this is a weird analogy, but if you look at a prison, so some 16-year-old kid goes to jail for drugs, whatever, he's in there for 6 years. It costs $110,000 to keep somebody in federal prison for a year, which is a lot more than the Harvard tuition. There's no education there.
It's a good line to draw, isn't it? More than a Harvard education.
It is, but but they also don't teach them anything. They sit there all day long. But why not have a teacher that says, okay, you know, if you're here, you've done stuff that's wrong. Can you read? Let's teach you to read. Have you read history? Let's do that. You know math? Why don't they use those? You know, you have literally a captive audience. You don't teach them anything, and I would say that reflects our values as a society, that we don't think it's actually critical to educate people. We look at it now as utilitarian, and it is actually what makes us human. Learning is what makes us human.
Do you think that's is it an image problem of education? Like, I think when I tell people that I am an educator, maybe with a small e, I'm not a teacher in a school or anything like that, but I do a lot of kind of teaching and running workshops and stuff like that. There's definitely, with some people, I notice a kind of cock of the head or a raised eyebrow. And whenever I say education, they default to a kind of feeling of school and it being linear and it being boring and all of that, all those kind of maybe negative connotations. Do you think education maybe has a slightly negative image?
Yeah, it probably does. And I think, and that's probably also a bit institutional. I mean, learning is fun and thinking is fun. Maybe not for everybody, but for the people for whom it is fun and interesting, you know, school can actually limit that. You know, I've often thought, why teach Huckleberry Finn at school? Or why teach Shakespeare at school, which I love, instead of the Hunger Games? Because get the kids to love literature. Then they can read Shakespeare on their own later on. But if you give them the Hunger Games or Harry Potter and they learn to love reading, then their imagination can run wild. But we actually present education to them as something that's painful. When people say, I'm not a maths person, all of the research shows that until the level of calculus, anybody can learn it. You know, if you can speak a language, your native language, you can actually do algebra. And there's no cognitive reason you can't, but there is an institutional one, which we tell people that they can't do it. You know, I was recently at an outdoor market, and I gave somebody $21 for $11 worth of cookies, and she pulled out an iPad to subtract 11 from 21. She pulled out an $800 iPad, and I said, like, I just let this go, and I said something. She said, "Well, I'm an art student," and I said, "That's no excuse." Anyway, I rant.
I think it's a great rant because saying, "Oh, I'm an art student," that's an easy thing to say, but it doesn't. It's kind of missing the point, right?
Well, it's missing the point, but it's the same as the investment banker who's got a PhD in mathematics says, "Well, I don't read novels." You know, we limit ourselves, and education should be fun, engaging. It should be at least as much fun as a hockey game or a football game or the ballet or the Olympics. Why is it? I mean, you look at a game like chess, which is very difficult. It's fun. They make it fun. I mean, chess is a lot more difficult than calculus. And yet, once it's a game, it's fun. So why shouldn't reading a book and doing your math homework be fun? Why structure it in a way that actually kills people's imagination?
Thinking about the slightly broader landscape in the speaking world, you mentioned at the beginning that it was like university cellar rooms and like, what, 40 people just kind of squeezed in there, and that would be about it. Now there's this kind of much broader speaking landscape. For someone who's maybe not familiar and doesn't have the benefit of your vantage point, what does that look like in terms of where your talent are appearing?
Well, it's interesting. Like, the fun part of this whole thing is, those 40 people who are in the basement, you know, those were also the six people who used to stay up until 5 o'clock in the morning talking about ideas at college or wherever, and we lose that, that hunger where, I mean, when you're 20 years old, everything is possible. And then when you're 40 years old, some things might be possible, but mostly it's all about probability, not about dreaming. So in some ways, some of those big ideas bring us back to what we dreamed about when we could talk about ideas all night. When I was a promoter, what I loved is that, you go to a movie and it's, oh, that was a great movie, where do you want to eat? But when I was a promoter and people were walking out of the lecture, they'd be talking about what the speakers had talked about. They'd be arguing with each other. And that was really exciting. Because most of the time when we read books, we don't have an opportunity. There's nobody to talk to about them anymore. At university, you'd all read the same book. You could all discuss it and argue about it. At a lecture, you've just all heard the same thing. So you can sit there and you can discuss it. You can discuss big ideas and little ideas. And you get passionate about it. And I think that we lose that. And I think that to some extent, some of the, some companies now have the luxury of just bringing in somebody who's really interesting to talk to their people. You know, they'll bring in a Jared Diamond or a Steve Pinker, a big thinker idea. Not somebody who's going to tell you how to make more money tomorrow from an idea I'm going to talk about today. But somebody says, this is what's happening in the world. And as an engaged, involved citizen, you should know about it. And you should, whether you agree with it or not, because disagreeing with some of these people is hard work. And to disagree with somebody is a good thing, as long as it's hard work.
I feel we could end up moving into politics a bit, because I'm just sensing a potential. So I'm going to try and hold off. But I sense that what you just said makes me think that now more than ever, you need people with differing ideas, big ideas, thinking about the world in other ways that you may not see in your kind of regular role. And it sounds like maybe that bringing those kind of people in feels more important now than maybe ever before.
Well, big ideas are wonderful. I mean, dreams are wonderful. I said, whatever, we stopped dreaming when we were kids, right? 20, I was, You know, at a restaurant, I asked the waitress was from Canada, from where I'm from. So I said, what are you doing here? I said, I want to be an actress. And, you know, she's 20 years old and she wants to be an actress. She's dreaming. And in 30 years, you know, what's she going to be? Is she going to still be dreaming about something else? And remember when America dreamed big? We said, like, you know what? Let's go to the moon. 8 years later, we went to the moon. Now it's like, you know, let's build a condo tower. And it takes 12 years to build a condo tower. And, you know, where are the big dreams that actually unified people, that we all got on side together and said, you know, that this is an exciting idea?
I think that's such an interesting point. And I'd love to get your take on, like, why you think that may be. What is it that's maybe stopped that wonder, I suppose, of wanting to go out and chase dreams? I mean, arguably, like Silicon Valley, that's still like a big thing, and in kind of the creative industries and other areas. But I think you really hit on something that, like, more generally, it feels like we're less likely to go and do that now.
Well, let's keep in mind that a lot of those dreams in Silicon Valley is to make an app about Angry Birds that wastes people time. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, yeah, innovation used to be about saving people's time. I mean, a dishwasher is wonderful. It saves you a lot of time.
Yep.
LinkedIn is useless. It wastes your time.
Ooh, controversial.
You know, I mean,
I broadly speaking agree with you, though.
Yeah, I mean, most of the social media applications we have suck our time away from us.
Yes.
You know, whereas if we could even get, you know, weirder about this, we can talk about, you know, the dishwasher is fundamentally more useful than LinkedIn. If you had a choice between one or the other, which would you take? The dishwasher also employed millions of people, making them, fixing them, moving them, selling them, whatever. But I think what we've lost is that collective dream. People might have an individual dream to make an app, but we had a collective dream to go to the moon. We had a collective dream for women's rights. We had a collective dream for civil rights. We've had collective dreams, but now the government's the enemy. And actually, I think that's entrenched very much, is that if you go to the TED conference, there's nobody from the government ever speaking. You know, the whole thing now is about Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos both have plans for space travel. And Jeff Bezos has had his for like 12 years now.
Yep.
Well, as I said, you know, collectively, from 1961 to 1969, we actually went to the moon collectively. But as an individual billionaire, it's taken him 12 years to go pretty much nowhere. So, but why do we celebrate that individual who's doing this rather than the collective that actually did more? When we get together and stop arguing, we can accomplish an incredible amount of stuff.
And I suppose going back to your point about reading books at university, the ones who are staying up till 5 a.m. kind of sharing knowledge, and now that isn't happening as much anymore, but within a lecture hall with a speaker who is compelling, and there's a group of people who all have said, I want to be there, I want to listen to this person, and I want to talk about it with the other people in the room afterwards, maybe that is where there is some collective dreaming can hopefully come about to a degree. But I definitely hear you at a kind of more macro level that it sounds like, yeah, that's dissipated somewhat.
Yeah, I think the nature of, you know, yeah, we could talk about the nature of communication. I mean, is it six people in a room anymore? Is it six people, you know, communicating on Facebook, which is very different. Even if they're communicating with each other, there's maybe a lack of urgency and permanence. But that idea of people getting together to discuss ideas and then acting on them is actually historically how people have been doing things for thousands of years. So maybe lectures will change the world again.
Hopefully. Yeah. I wanted to go into a couple of other topics before we start to wrap. I'd be really interested to get your take on the term polymath, actually. So in terms of, like, expertise, do you notice that many of your talent that you represent operate in multiple different areas? So I'm thinking, for example, like Common or Donald Glover, kind of more contemporary kind of talents, are working across multi kind of mediums. Whether they're polymath or not, I don't know. But I'd be really interested to get your take on what you see as a polymath, or whether most of the more successful people you work with tend to be very, very focused on one specific area.
I think what happens, most of the people are they have a broad knowledge and of a lot of things, but they might have a very strong specific knowledge about one or two things. Which is important, you know, because actually I think they've even shown that you always get your best ideas from people who have nothing to, from areas that have nothing to do with your principal area of expertise. And there's all kinds of studies on things like that. So if you're not exposing yourself to radically different things, you're missing out. I mean, I always find it fascinating when I speak to, say, an investment banker who's proud of the fact that they've never read a novel. I think, you know, you're missing out. You know, you're actually cutting off, a significant part of something that you might find actually gives you great ideas. And when you look at some of the great, you know, a polymath, I mean, Jared Diamond's books, you know, he's got a new one coming out in May that I've been reading, I think, which is going to be hugely popular. And it's going to revolve around it's going to inspire some big discussions about crises. The whole book is about how individuals and nations deal with crises, and what the commonality is, and what the differences are. And then there's a big section on what's happening in the world today. And I think I think only a polymath could have done that, because only somebody who's interested in history, big ideas, but also historical ideas, geography, medicine, who has a broad perspective can bring that to the table.
Sounds like that will connect into the concept of the collective as well. How collectives and countries actually go and solve crises.
Well, it is true. It is very it is collective in all of these situations. It is only collective action that allows nations to survive.
Speaking of books, you mentioned the Jared Diamond book that's about to come out. I wanted to touch on your book collection. I know you're quite a voracious reader. I'd love to kind of hear a little bit about your reading habits, maybe some of the books that mean most to you either recently or maybe throughout your life, like some of the things that have really stood out.
Yeah, I was definitely a voracious reader. I remember getting into trouble once, you know, in like grade 8, the teachers all said, "What did you do over? How many books did you read over the summer?" And people say, "Oh, one or two or three," and I said 60, and it, you know, and everyone yelled at me. And I went home and I said, "Mom, how many books did I read?" And she said, "I don't know, 75. And I just read everything. And it was really funny, though, when I was a little kid, there were only actually two books in the house, The Fountainhead and Brother Dusty Feet. And I read both of them.
I'm reading The Fountainhead right now.
Well,
first time, actually.
Really? I read it about 10 times. It was missing the last page. So I never knew. You know,
I haven't finished it yet, so don't tell me.
But I would just read everything. And then when I was mid-teens, I sort of got a bit more focused, and I did the typical stuff. I read all of the I could only afford books in secondhand bookstores because we were really poor. So all of my literature was based on what was available in the secondhand bookstores at the time. So I read all the Russians. I loved, the Brothers Karamazov was my favorite book as a teenager, and that, and actually The Groundwork for Metaphysics of Morals, were my two favorite books as a teenager. I don't know. And Henry Miller. And then one of my favorite books was The Books of My Life by Henry Miller, because then I just went out and I read every single book he recommended. And then sometimes every book by that author, like every book by Newt Hampson, I would go to the library and find bizarre stuff from, you know, the turn of the 19th century. And yeah, it was just fun. I just read everything and fiction, you know, mostly fiction, nonfiction, some philosophy. And I just kept doing that. It was just... And that's how I managed to, you know, I didn't go to university because I couldn't afford it. So I took my grant money and disappeared. But I still had read probably a couple of thousand books by the time I was 20. So I had some education.
You mentioned before we started recording that some of your library has disappeared.
Well, I kept carrying it around with me, and I thought, well, if I haven't read, you know, Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart since I bought it when I was 15 years old, maybe I can get rid of it. And when I did, and then Margaret Atwood said to me, "You haven't read When Things Fall Apart? What is the matter with you?" Oh God.
Uh-oh.
But there was like you ran out of space, you know, and after a while it was like somebody else should read these books.
It's kind of timely because we're recording this the week that the Marie Kondo Netflix show around kind of the joy of tidying up, I think it's called, has landed. And there's been a bit of a backlash because she said, I'm paraphrasing somewhat, that after X amount of books, you should just get rid of them because you should keep your place minimal. And there's been a backlash about that because books have a different kind of feel to other inanimate objects in a in a house and for somebody, I think.
Well, I would say she doesn't know what a book is. That's the problem. She doesn't know what a book is. I mean, I remember somebody I was dating, and she said, you don't have, like, photographs of your trips and stuff like that here. And I said, well, look, I've got, see this copy of The Idiot that doesn't have a cover? I read that on the bus from San Francisco to Boston. Now that, there's my photograph of my trip. That's it. It's my book. And that's what a book is.
I actually have a similar, like, as a kind of adjacency to that. There's definitely books I remember from traveling as well. For me, there's also kind of music as well. So I very much remember, like, particular albums from a trip. If I was listening to music on headphones on a flight while reading, like, those, for me, those are the things that seem to be more memorable. And I don't take many photos. My wife's always on at me that I don't take enough photos. But I don't, really. I prefer literature and audio to kind of these photographic moments in time.
And as a slight digression, when I was like, what do I read? I mean, it was actually a song that changed my reading habits. I read everything, but when I was 16, I'd set my alarm clock for 8:45 so I could get to school by 9. And the clock radio went off, and there was this thing on the radio going, Einstein is disguised as Robin Hood. He's fighting in the captain's tower. I was like, this is a song? What is this? And I was listening to this, and then at the end of it, they said, that's Desolation Row by Bob Dylan. I thought, wow. So I skipped school, went down, bought the record, listened to it all day long. And look at the liner notes, and they mentioned, you know, Jack Kerouac and these things. And Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot obviously were in the song. So I went out and I got all these books, and I started reading them. That focused my reading, you know, so that it was no longer just, you know, what was at hand. It was, this is the path.
I love that. I want to zoom back out a little bit before we finish up. Talking about talent again. So if we've talked about Bob Dylan, we talked about Margaret Atwood, we talked about Jared Diamond. Who are some of the kind of upcoming talents that you, either that you and the agency are working with, or maybe other talent that you admire, upcoming talent that maybe listeners may not be familiar with that you think are worth keeping an eye out this year and beyond?
Oh, that's difficult. It's like asking somebody what your favorite child is.
Yeah, sorry.
But I'll tell you who the best speaker I've ever seen in my life is.
Oh, please do.
So just like a good politician, I won't answer your question.
you did mention politician CEOs lying. As long as you don't lie, that's fine.
No, I won't lie. But the best speaker I've ever seen in my life, I've already alluded to, somebody who got 2 standing ovations and then people say the talk's boring. But Bill Strickland, I saw him speak and it was mind-blowing. He got up on stage and said, you know, it's really nice of you people here to invite me to give a speech, but I didn't really prepare a talk because, you know, words don't change that much. But if you don't mind, I'm going to show you some pictures of where I work. And I was standing next to the organizer at the time, who was almost in tears. He thought, this is going to be a disaster. Within 2 minutes, you could hear a pin drop, you know, and then 45 minutes later, the room exploded. And what he did is he runs a vocational training school in Pittsburgh. So you sit there and say, the greatest speaker I've ever seen is somebody who runs a vocational training school in Pittsburgh. You go, what, David, what are you, crazy? No, it's got to be some president or some huge, no, this guy will change your life. One of my staff said that they had never been so proud of working at the agency as they were when they heard him speak. And somebody said the world would be a better place if everybody in it listened to Bill. He's one of the finest people I've ever met and the best speaker I've ever heard.
Bill Strickland.
Bill Strickland out of Pittsburgh.
Fantastic. This has been such a wonderful conversation. I would love to go for another hour. We were going to talk about, we were threatening to talk about politics and other kind of things too. Maybe that's for a part two.
But don't forget, I'm Canadian. You know what Canadians say?
What do Canadians say?
President Obama was a right-wing fanatic.
Right.
So.
Well, I'm a Brit, and we've got Brexit and other things to deal with. So I'm gonna keep my mouth shut for today.
Yeah, I think you can.
I got enough to worry about. David, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to the Jared Diamond book and looking up some Bill Strickland online, but hopefully seeing him in person, because that's the best way to do it, right?
The best way to do it. It's theatre.
We'll be back next time with another edition of Tickets. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review or a rating via your preferred podcast provider, or just tell a friend. And if you have any questions on this episode or suggestions for new ones, please drop me a line. Just head over to howardgray.net, that's Gray with an A, / podcast. Thanks for listening.